close on Sunday, March 28th, and we are overjoyed to let you all know that we've surpassed our initial goal of $25,000 and have raised a little over $30,000 to date. As always, we're accepting donations year-round. Thank you to our listeners for continuing to support Grassroots Community Media. Your donations and support underline our mandate of people-powered radio. If you made a pledge but have not yet paid, please do so by May 1st to be eligible.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 24 days into the month of March. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, we have a series of clips from shows from the past year in order to celebrate the year of broadcasting remote during the COVID-19 pandemic. Plus, we've got tons of info on our current funding drive. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @AvalancheCKUT.
Level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided. It is forbidden to leave your home between 9:30 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about other measures in place to fight COVID-19. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. As you know, CKUT's funding drive is currently happening. If you would like to support the show directly, be sure to go to ckut.ca and make a donation. Remember to check Avalanche as your show of choice. We've got tons of cool prizes this year, and certain donation tiers get you pretty interesting gifts. In order to check out all that's available, again, be sure to check out ckut.ca. Up first this hour is an interview that was aired in June of 2020 with Tech Saint-Jean Menard from Mouvement FAS. That's up next. First up this hour, an interview with Tech Saint-Jean Menard from Mouvement FAS on the organization's recent letter to the Quebec government concerning the treatment of people with disabilities during the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Hi, Tex. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm a community organizer at Mouvement FAS. It's a People with Disabilities for Access to Services. Voices. We're a group that basically defend the rights of disabled people to have better access to social and health services.
So you recently signed a letter with Mouvement FOST titled Crisis or Not, People with Disabilities Are Invisible. What is this letter about?
Well, the letter is basically about the fact that disabled people they are more invisibilized during this crisis than they were before. And like I state this for a fact, they are invisibilized in normal times, but they are even mm-hmm. more right now. We don't see them on any platforms. They don't talk about them, the impact the crisis has on them. The focus is always elsewhere, but people with disabilities also suffer and need support in these hard times.
How has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted populations unevenly?
Well, we see seniors were stuck for a while in CHSLDs and other type of resources. Well, as we say in the letter, it's the same for people with disabilities living in different type of resources. There's isolation, stress, misunderstanding, and more like the fact that many people with disabilities living at home have been deprived of their home support services. There's many other examples I could give you.
And how have the official communications of government officials sidelined disabled people in their messages?
Well, to put simply, disabled people were rarely mentioned in press conferences. There's also barely any information circulating in the public space concerning issues concerning them. They were never the focus, not even once, considering that the crisis was at some point the focus. Well, it was focused on CHSLDs and that disabled people represent roughly 10% of the population in CHSLDs. Well, it's evident for us that the disabled people were sidelined since they barely mentioned them.
So do you feel as if the ways in which these messages have been presented have been accessible? For example, when Legault talks, is that messaging accessible?
Well, not enough. No, when he's talking, sometimes he's unclear. And for like some people, it's really hard to understand. I mean, sometimes even I don't understand properly. So I think that's problematic. But also when you have to dig up the information to understand what your own government's saying, I mean, that's definitely a problem. Mm-hmm. They're trying, but not hard enough.
And how can the government improve their outreach to disabled people during the ongoing pandemic?
Their explanations needs to be clearer. So the time when they announce something, we need some further explanation. Sometimes they publish info on social medias, but not everyone has access to internet or can use it as easily as anybody. Sometimes their publications take time to be accessible for, like, for example, blind people. And sometimes they should just make their official documents, well, not so hard to find. When you watch the press conference, you can like see the ASL, which is nice. It's a start, but I mean, they could probably do something else.
And how have health and social services in Quebec been chronically underfunded?
Well, during the Liberal Party years, we all know that there were massive cuts with their austerity measures following their recession. But also when you consider the huge waiting lists, they're getting longer and longer and cuts in multiple services. Plus, well, there was a massive reorganization of the health and social services network that happened back in 2015. So yeah, you have an explosive cocktail for the health and social services network. Lots of unsatisfied people that don't have access to services to cover their most basic needs, and that's problematic.
So underfunded areas of health and social services like specialized housing and home support have now become the epicenter of the pandemic. Do you feel that some of the deaths associated to these areas could have been prevented had Quebec invested in ensuring their safety?
Yeah, totally. Better infrastructures, more healthcare workers, more people able to stay at home instead of being put in CHSLDs because, well, they can hire workers at a proper wage and for more times during the day. I mean, it's just like basic for us at Mouvement FOST. The CHSLDs were the major problem, and like just by not moving people in the CHSLDs would be, I mean, a good thing because they could stay at home, they could like be more autonomous, they could go out and still being taken care of. by health workers coming at their home.
And how have the immediate and family type resources been cut as a result of this pandemic?
Well, to put simply, there's less people working there because of the miserable salaries. We could say that there's been an exodus towards the public system that offer better salaries. And yeah, this is a big preoccupation for us.
And for listeners unaware, what's the difference in quality between the private centers and the public centers?
For a starter, there's the salaries. Generally, people working in other resources don't have the same conditions as in the public system because of like some regulations. There's a couple of differences. They're kind of sometimes hard to explain, and I'm not necessarily very good at it. But there's the people working in some other types of resources, not in the public, don't necessarily have the same trainings. Yeah, so there's a couple of issues there also.
How have the rights of disabled people been infringed on with factors like underfunding and cuts to service?
For example, some services were deemed non-essential or drastically cut in terms of hours allocated, but we consider them essential and they should have been maintained. Some people had access to services where people would go clean their home for them, but at some point they were deemed non-essential. As I said, try living in a house where all your dirty plates are laying everywhere because you can't wash them yourself. The floor is dirty. You drop something, you can't clean it. That's terrible. I mean, for a couple of weeks or months, they changed it and put some of this services back on the essential lists. But already some workers were not working for these for this industry anymore. So like there was a lack of services. Some people were stuck inside their tiny bedrooms without being able to even go in the corridors for months. Some people couldn't see their relatives, not even on tablets or anything, because they don't have access to them. So yeah, that's highly problematic.
Do you feel that with the deficit due to the economic downturn that's happened as a result of the shutdown, further cuts will be made to health and social services for disabled people?
Well, that's one of our things that we're worried a lot about in these days, because last time we were in a recession, massive cuts, the story might repeat itself.
And how do you think that these cuts would impact the attempt to stop the spread of the pandemic? Do you feel the pandemic would just get worse?
It's tough to say. I mean, everything changes so quickly and we don't know a lot, but we're scared that it's going to get worse. And like, I mean, if it does, that could be terrible.
And what policy needs to be implemented in order to ensure greater equity for people with disabilities in the context of COVID-19?
Well, first of all, they need to be considered as people as important as everybody else. They need to be listened to. We think they know what's good for them, and they're not listening to them. They need to be, as I said, considered as valuable members of our society, and their needs, their basic needs, need to be answered. They need to be heard and not invisibilized.
And what needs to be implemented to ensure more equitable society as we rebuild and restructure post-pandemic?
Well, there's a need for better funding, both in the public health and social services network, but also in community organizations as ourselves. There is a need for better access to decision-making for everybody in the population, and injustices need to be recognized and resolved.
And how can individuals read this letter or share this letter?
The letter should be on our website right now and on our Facebook page, and the French version has been published in both Le Soleil and Journal Métro.
If listeners wanted to learn more about your organization, where can they find that information?
Well, they can go on mouvementphase.org or on our Facebook page, Mouvement Phase. Everything is there.
A reading of the letter Crisis or Not, People with Disabilities Are Invisible, published by Mouvement Phase. Personnes handicapées pour l'accès aux services. Signed by Mathieu Francoeur and Tex Saint-Jean-Ménard. At the beginning of the health crisis,
The resulting social and economic effects have hit the various groups in Quebec society unevenly. Many actors and observers have pointed out that the current situation has acted as a reminder of the systemic injustices and daily discrimination experienced by vulnerable or minority populations. People with disabilities and their relatives have always been sidelined or invisibilized in the public space. Unfortunately, in these exceptional times, they are even more forgotten in the announcements and communications of elected officials and public and private managers, as well as in the media, than they were before the crisis. During this Quebec Week of Persons with Disabilities, QWPD, we would like to remind you that long before the difficult situation we are experiencing collectively, individuals, families, and community organizations were fighting to improve access to many basic services and to have their rights respected. For example, in health and social services, there are chronic problems of underfunding and wait lists in several programs and services, such as family support, day activities, and social professional programs, early childhood rehabilitation services, accompaniment, respite for families, etc. Moreover, how can we not point out the historical neglect of specialized housing and home support, a real blind spot of the health and social services network, which have become the epicenter of the crisis in the last few weeks? We have talked a great deal about the unaccessible situation of seniors, but few people know that people with physical disabilities under the age of 65 reside in CHSLDs, that adults with intellectual disability or an autism spectrum disorder, ASD, are numerous in intermediate and family-type resources, IRFTR, and that for nearly 3 months now, many people with disabilities living at home have been deprived of their home support services. What do we do about the rights of individuals and families, both of those enshrined in the Charters of Rights, international conventions, and those included in the Act respecting health and social services? Already these rights were regularly violated in normal times. We are concerned not only about the current dramatic situations in which many people find themselves, but also about the situation that will prevail in a few weeks or months for the services and programs reserved for them. Over the past year and a half, the CAQ government has announced certain sums to meet some needs, but because of years of cuts and reorganizations combined with growing needs, they are largely insufficient. In a few weeks, the government will release its economic update. With a major deficit looming, what will be left to improve health and social services? Adapted transportation, specialized education services, universal accessibility, adapted housing, and others. When we are told that we must clean up public finances, tighten our belts, or revive the hard-hit sectors of the economy, will people with disabilities and families be once again sacrificed and forgotten? The letter can be found on Mouvement FOSS's website.
CKUT's annual funding drive runs Thursday, March 18th to Sunday, March 28th. Our programmers have been working hard at home all year, and it's time to celebrate their efforts. The theme of our first ever online drive is sowing the seeds of grassroots change, and we're asking you to support independent community media. Help us reach our goal of $25,000. Go to ckut.ca to donate today.
Sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds of change.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. CKUT's funding drive is currently happening. If you wanted to make a donation to support the show, be sure to check out ckut.ca. From there, you can make a donation directly to The Avalanche, which goes to support various programming costs. All support goes directly to CKUT, which helps power the station. If you're interested in supporting news produced by and for the Montreal community, now is the perfect time to donate. Again, check out ckut.ca/donate or call 514-448-4013. Up next is an interview we aired in April of 2020 with Anne Borden from Autistics for Autistics Ontario. That's up now.
Hi, welcome to the show. I'm here with Anne from Autistics for Autistics Ontario. And would you be able to describe the history of your organization and your work with it?
Yes, it's great to be here too. Thanks for inviting me. Our organization was founded in November of 2017, and it was co-founded. I'm one of the co-founders, as a way for autistic people to be able to speak for ourselves. So it's an autistic self-advocacy organization. We do work in community education, political advocacy, and community support and community building.
And you recently wrote a plain language guide on COVID-19. Would you Would you mind describing the contents of it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have it right in front of me. We came up with this idea, a couple of us in the group, to get something out there about COVID-19 that's in plain language, meaning that more people can understand it. It's not full of a lot of technical jargon. And also specifically for autistic people, talking about some of the things that we would specifically be concerned about. So it starts out with talking about what COVID-19 is, explains why we're sheltering in place or staying at home, as we are here in Ontario. And then it gives some resources for people who use AAC, which is alternative communication devices, people who are non-speaking. Gives some resources for people who are non-speaking for navigating the medical system and what's going on and having access to communication. And then it talks a little bit about kind of coping and how to connect with people, how to cope with what's going on, with a little bit of advice as well for caregivers if someone is living with a caregiver. And then a brief discussion about what might happen next, because that was a really big question that a lot of people have.
Could you describe why plain language is necessary in communications for COVID-19 and others?
It's really, really important, and we don't see very much of it. I'm really surprised with COVID how little communication is coming out of the medical field that can be understood by the average person. A lot of it's really technical, and you start looking at all these big words and long paragraphs, and it feels very overwhelming, and it's hard to understand. So it's really, really important, especially in the case of something where it's about health and safety, to make sure that it's plain language. The challenge with plain language is that sometimes plain language guides, if they're not written by actually disabled people, they can come across as kind of patronizing, right? And kind of like talking down to the person. So the best people to write plain language guides are people who are autistic, have Down syndrome, a variety of intellectual disabilities, really driving these projects, writing these projects, or at the very least, very heavily consulting and very heavily involved with these kind of guides so that they really speak to people in a way that is comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any other plain language guides that have been circulating? And how does yours differ from those that have already been created?
Yeah, there are some good ones. I will say Harvard did plain language, but then they kind of messed it up because they had it like by age group, like for 5 to 7-year-olds, like that doesn't really work. You know, cognition isn't kind of broken down like grades in school. However, Brandeis did a really nice one, and that could be read by people of any age, Brandeis University. Another great one was written by the Green Mountain Self-Advocates, and that was actually written by people who are disabled, have intellectual or developmental disability. So that was written in a really, really accessible way. Mm-hmm. And then there's Our Guide, and these are the major ones. There are also some good guides by AAC makers. Cough Drop, I think, has a guide. And there's another guide by Assistive Wear. Assistive Wear has been doing a lot of good guides and information for people who are using AAC to communicate.
And do you believe that the methods that the government has used thus far to communicate vital information regarding COVID-19 has been sufficient?
I think they could do a better job with plain language, especially by consulting with people who understand plain language and know how to write using plain language and benefit from plain language. I think for sure they could be doing a better job.
So governmental briefings on coronavirus only recently began offering accessibility measures, for example, sign language interpretation, the week of March 16th. Why do you think the implementation of methods of communication such as this were considered later in comparison to quote-unquote traditional communication?
I think it's that way so much of the time that disabled people are an afterthought. And I don't know why. I mean, especially federally, because they've made this big statement about how they're going to start, what's the expression that they use, like including disability in everything they do, like right from the start. So it was actually, I was surprised at how long it took them because I knew that they had this new commitment, but I haven't really seen a lot of legs to that commitment, and that was really disappointing. And I think there still is more work to be done to reach various disabled communities in the way they communicate.
The Accessible Canada Act, in its current status, primarily refers to federal physical, like governmental bodies, so for example, government buildings. Do you feel that language should have been included in the creation of this act?
It really, really should have. And like any disability accommodation, it will benefit everyone, not just disabled people, if they had included language in that. The legislation also really didn't have anything for autistic people, and there was no consultation done with autistic people for that legislation. So there are a number of things missing there.
Are there methods of communication that the government hasn't yet implemented that would be able to better assist disabled people?
I think so. I think that they need to communicate more directly with disability self-advocacy groups and disability self-advocates and ask, what are different communities and individuals need? And then respond to that need. I don't think having a bunch of quote unquote experts who are non-disabled trying to just kind of do guesswork on the fly in the background as an afterthought is going to be a good way to do it. We'd like to see the government really reaching out directly to groups like ours and asking us what's missing and what we need. And we can provide it. I mean, it's very simple for us to do that rather than having them kind of doing guesswork.
And do you feel that the accessibility measures regarding language have been adequately communicated by caregivers to the populations that require them? For example, in the blog post, you mentioned that there are soundboards specific to COVID-19. Is this a feature that's widely known to caregivers as a resource?
I mean, I think the companies that make these boards are trying to get the information out there, but I don't think that it's entirely successful. I think if someone, it all depends on the quality of who's caring for the person and where the person lives. If they're living in a residential program where the people are really not putting effort into knowing what's new and knowing what's going on and querying these things, I don't think they're going to find them. You know, you would really need something. This is all happening kind of ad hoc by private groups like ours. In the case of AAC, it might be a company that's making AAC, but if you don't use that brand, you might never hear about it. Ideally, you would have kind of a master post, a master list that the government had of accessibility resources, and then they would distribute these resources to all of the residential programs and all of the schools in terms of how they're doing education, the way that they're doing education now. And they would have a way to get it to parents as well through various agencies. But that's not happening.
And why do you feel it isn't happening?
I don't think they have had a plan. I don't know. I mean, I'm just speculating at this point, but it doesn't look like they had thought about these various moving pieces when they were getting ready for something like a pandemic. So they need to reach out and ask people in the disability community. And I mean, really disabled people. In the case of autistic people, there is a whole bunch of non-autistic people who claim to speak for us, groups like CASDA and some of these other Autism Speaks. If the government's going and asking them, they're going to the wrong people. Those people are not disabled, and they don't know what it's like to be autistic, and they don't know what autistic people need. They need to reach out directly to self-advocates to understand what's needed.
How does the level of like recommendations vary when provided by someone such as like a representative from Autism Speaks who necessarily doesn't have autism versus directly from a person with autism?
Well, we're asking everyone in the broader disability community not to partner with or work with organizations like Autism Speaks, or CASDA in particular, because they are, first of all, in the case of Autism Speaks, there's the broader issue of the genetic research and some of the eugenics that they support. But aside from that, they also really follow what's known as the medical model of disability, where the disabled person is the problem and you fix the child to make them fit in a world that isn't built for them. The social model of disability tells us, why don't we make some changes to the world around us so that it can fit us? And it's the same for autism as it is for any disability, right? And I think that these big groups that kind of speak, they tend to speak as though we're broken puzzle pieces that need to be fixed, and what kind of therapies and things can we get so that we're not so weird and whatever, like, is really damaging to autistic people in many, many ways. And it doesn't make for successful outcomes either. If the government and policymakers are looking for successful outcomes, the only way you're going to have that is if we look at autism from the social model of disability and start making changes to the environment. And the only people that can really communicate what changes are needed, whether it's in school, whether it's in healthcare, or anywhere else, the only people who are really going to be able to articulate what's needed is actually autistic people. Like, for example, we go, Autistics for Autistics, our group, goes to the University of Toronto Medical School a couple of times a year, and we give a talk about to med students, how can you make your practice accessible for people who use AAC, for people with sensory issues, for people with communication differences, all of the types of challenges that we know that we have faced when we have tried to seek healthcare. We know what the barriers are that we face, and we know that there are some really simple solutions. And when we go in and speak to the med students about how they can make their practice more accessible, they're very receptive, they're very open. It's really a simple matter of teaching them some really simple accessibility measures that will have an impact on hundreds of people throughout their career. But we're the only ones doing it. It's the autistic people that are doing it. When you have an autism organization like Autism Speaks or someone coming in, they're much more likely to talk about how to identify autism or kind of make us seem like we're like sort of a germ in a petri dish rather than, hey, we're people. And it would really help if you learned a little bit about this. It would really help if you could allow your patients to email if they are not able to use the phone, things like that. And that all comes from the grassroots, the disability rights community, not from these big organizations who claim to speak for us.
And have these organizations, for example, spoken or released anything in regards to COVID-19? And what are your thoughts on those?
I've been looking. Now, I haven't seen anything from Autism Speaks. I kind of don't like looking at what they do. Yeah. Because of the eugenics, et cetera. But I have seen some organizations that have put out guides. Generally, they're putting out like a guide for caregivers. And then it'll be this like massive long document of like how to talk to your child about COVID. So already they've taken the subjectivity away from the actually autistic person. They're not addressing autistic people, they're addressing their carers, and that just symbolic of how they tend to do things. And I just saw one today, I couldn't believe it, someone sent it to me, I can't remember who put it out. It was a Canadian group from the West, and they did this whole big thing, this whole big website, they probably had grant money for it, and they never once mentioned non-speaking, non-verbal autistic people. They had it all set up for autistic people who could speak, but we know that like 30% of autistic people are either non-speaking or partially speaking. It's quite incredible that a big agency like that would just render all those people invisible in their document.
And how has the community in Ontario been impacted by the crisis?
I think it's been impacted depending on where you live and who you are. So for some people who are living on their own or with roommates out on their own, they are facing in many, many cases, because poverty is a big problem in our community, facing a lot of economic insecurity and a lot of worry about what might happen to their job, a lot of worry about what's going to happen with Ontario Works or ODSP or some of the programs that people are receiving. So there is anxiety and uncertainty and fear around the economic part of it. Then there's the social isolation, which everyone has to deal with, but which feels a little bit different maybe for an autistic person than it would for a neurotypical person. I don't want to generalize to all autistic people. I think there are some stereotypes out there that we all just want to sit home and pet our cat, and we don't really care that we have to stay home, and we're all introverts, and that's not really true. Like, a lot of autistic people are really extroverted, and I think anyone, whether you're autistic or not, is missing the community, missing the routine. But I think from a sensory perspective, it can be more difficult being inside than it might be for someone else. It can be particularly difficult for people who are living in a group home setting or in a family setting where they're not happy and not comfortable, or that's not welcoming for them. I really, really worry about people in those kind of situations where there may have been an opportunity to get out for work and get out for school, and now they're home. So there's that as well. And then there's the sense of not knowing what's coming, which is something that impacts everyone. But it can be especially frustrating and can really start to lead you down a path of reading and learning and understanding and getting super duper into understanding COVID to the point where it's like, oh, you know, okay, I've learned everything possible about COVID now. I need to find ways to decompress. I need to find ways to connect with other people. So I guess to summarize, there's economic concerns. There are stress concerns of depending on people's living situations. And then there are sensory and coping concerns that do look and feel different than they do for a lot of neurotypical people.
And how is the government of Ontario dealing with this crisis?
I'm just giving my opinion as an individual. I was really surprised. I watched Ford yesterday giving a press conference, and he was kind of being baited by the right-wing media to make negative comments about Trudeau and by a certain reporter, and he deflected it, and he praised Trudeau. And I was really happy to see that. Like, it does seem like the government is taking its direction from public health experts, whether they're federal or whether they're provincial. So that was really comforting for me. The fallout once this is all over, I don't know. Like, I don't really know economically and socially what kind of impact it's going to have on our community, because so many in our community are already living in very low income and living on ODSP. That conversation isn't really happening right now, so it's really hard to tell, because it is a Tory government, what that's really going to be like in the future in terms of funding and aid.
And what are your opinions on the fact that the majority of disability support plans across Canada are below the poverty line, but with the bill that has been proposed, individuals would be receiving almost twice as much, for example, as recipients of ODSP. How do you feel that proposal impacts the level that we've set for essentially putting disabled people in poverty for no reason?
Well, it certainly points out the existing system, that the way that it isn't fair and the way that people are constantly living on the poverty line, and people who want to work a little bit get penalized for that. People who want to live with their partner or get married obviously are penalized right now under that system. This, for us as activists, it's an opportunity for us to raise awareness and say, well, compare the aid that's being provided by the government to what we're getting. It's a good opportunity to make people aware of the discrepancies and the second-class citizenship that comes from those discrepancies.
How can non-disabled people be allies to disabled people during this pandemic?
I think non-disabled people can be allies for disabled people by giving us a place at the podium. I think it's really, really important in any kind of project that has to do with COVID at all, that disabled people are right there, mm-hmm. front and center, because we're in a place right now where we have space in Ontario for everyone in the hospital. But as we know, down in the U.S., they're rationing care. And mm-hmm. as we know, sometimes the rationing programs exclude people that are disabled and are discriminatory towards people that are disabled. And there's a lot of worry and concern in Canada that that could happen here, depending on the direction that things go with healthcare.
1 year ago, CKUT shut down our studios for the safety of each other. Gradually, we adapted and found ways to continue to produce programming that reflects our shared experience, physically distanced, but socially connected. Help us keep that connection by donating to CKUT. Call 514-448-4013. Pop a check in the mail, 3647 University Montreal, H3A2B3, or donate online at ckut.ca.
Welcome back to CKUT 90.3 FM. Our funding drive is happening right now. If you wanted to make a donation to support news produced by and for the Montreal community, consider making a donation during our funding drive. The easiest way to do so is to go to ckut.ca/donate or CKUT's main page and make a donation online with your credit card. If you wanted to make a donation by phone, you can call 514-448-4013. If you wanted to support the Avalanche directly, be sure to check Avalanche as your show of choice during checkout. Prizes this year include hats, bags, and entries to the grand prize draw. Prizes for this year's grand prize draw includes books from Drawn and Quarterly, gift cards to Lola Rosa, and so much more. In order to check out all the details, go to funding.ckut.ca or check out ckut.ca in order to be redirected to the funding page. Now is an interview with participants of the Why Us campaign, which seeks to protest Bill C-7, an amendment to the Assisted Dying Act. Trigger warning. This piece mentions death and suicide. Why Us is a campaign by Project Value that seeks to critique the amendment of the Assisted Dying Act with Bill C-7 that specifically includes language that targets disabled people. To speak on this bill, we're joined by Aaron Clark, Dr. Jeff Preston, and Kevin Penny. We would like to preface this piece with a trigger warning on suicide and brief mention of abortion. That's up now.
Really, all that the Bill C-7 is doing is targeting that reasonable foreseeable death clause. And so I think what can be really difficult from a media perspective for, you know, headline news, for newspapers, for radio shows, even just like this, even, is that there is a nuance and complexity to the impacts of C-7 that are not drawn out explicitly within the bill itself. Right. BC7 is pitched as being all about personal choice, that they say, you know, we're not forcing anybody to receive euthanasia. We're merely allowing people to make the right decision, which, generally speaking, politically speaking, ideologically speaking, I am very much in favor of personal choice. I think the disabled population for far too long have had decisions made for them by experts, as opposed to being given the ability to choose. But what Bill C-7 doesn't address, or doesn't even start to get into, is the absolute complexity of making such a choice. It presumes that the decision people are making is between either enduring tremendous bodily anguish and suffering, or having a, quote, merciful death. But as we have seen time and again throughout history, disabled populations have been both overtly and very covertly targeted for elimination. And what Bill C-7 does is it opens up the door, it fast tracks the ability for people to opt out. So then we're left with an even more urgent question. If the government is going to do this much to allow for us to die, what steps is the federal government going to do to actually enable us to live? Because that is found nowhere within Bill C-7.
Well, and something that, you know, Jeff said about this being about choice and supporting our right to choose, and the word autonomy has been thrown around a lot. And we currently struggle to exercise agency on a daily basis, and not because things are difficult for us physically, but because people in authority and organizations and systems actively prohibit us from accessing education and from accessing employment. And, you know, there are processes in place that make it incredibly difficult to access housing equipment that we need that enables us to be independent, and access to the medication that would, you know, in some cases stabilize people's health conditions. And a lot of it, I think, relates to what Jeff was saying about earlier, about there's a fantasy about what disability is in the minds of people who are non-disabled. And it was crafted by non-disabled people. And it's potent. It's every metaphor in every movie since the beginning of movies, and then storytelling before that. And, you know, a thing that comes up about that a lot is how it objectifies our experience so completely that the individual experience, us as people, is completely erased. And, you know, I'll have the experience of meeting somebody who's never really interacted with a disabled person before. All they have is the ideas in their head of what that should look like and what that must mean for me. And the conversation or the interaction will start right off the bat with, oh my God, I could never, you know, like, it's so amazing that you're out, or, you know, it's so good for me to see you here, because if this was me, I could never live this way. I would rather die than live this way. And these are people I don't know that I've not encouraged an interaction with. I'm grabbing my coffee at the Starbucks, or I'm buying some, you know, groceries. And they're having this moment where what they expect the disability to look like doesn't match what they're experiencing or seeing of me in public going about my day-to-day life. And instead of that suggesting that they might be wrong about that perception, or that that entire idea and fantasy of disability might not apply, they assume that there's something like otherworldly special about me. I mean, people will get on their knees and cry because I have crossed a street by myself. It's not proportional to what I'm actually, like, my actual function in the world. And I think the intensity that people have to the fantasy of disability is part of the issue for us in the bill. And that seems very abstract. I realize that, like, we're talking about a piece of legislation that's very concrete. They want to pass it into a law that amends the criminal code, right? Like, that's significant to me. But I think that the reason why it's been so difficult to have a conversation about it in that environment, in the House of Commons, where that the power is, mm-hmm. is because they're all part of that fantasy. They're using an image of this suffering disabled person that they created, and then they're sharing it amongst each other and don't want to hear that that doesn't actually fit for a large majority of disabled people and their lived experience.
Well, I think there's some way, I think, Aaron, you're right on there, but I think I've heard this many times and I kind of buy into it now, is our disabilities aren't really what disables us. It's our environment and the people around us that's more disabling than anything else. And I see that in so many ways, like employment, education, housing. If you don't give people basic needs, how do you expect them to be productive members of society and live a good life? But if their environment is creating barriers to all these things and they have to fight even though to even get in the door, that's what's disabling. And your life would be pretty freaking shitty if that was the case. Luckily, I don't have that situation. I consider myself maybe privileged, but I've got those supports in place and I have those and I know what my life is. But I see other individuals who do not and have to fight for $25 more a month for something, a high fiber diet, and they get that denied. But what that means to people is huge. Like, that could, and it's just, well, you don't need that. So it's our society, I think, in general, who are disabling and not disability itself. Because, yeah, I have a C4 spinal cord injury. I'm paralyzed from the chest down. But I have a damn good life that I want to continue to live and prosper and explore. And so it's really heartening that, like Aaron and Jeff, and we've all kind of pushed forward that it's society that are making these decisions or these assumptions on our behalf. And I'm so glad why our Why Us campaign really got out there quickly and got feedback from the people who this will affect. Yeah, to sum it up, I think our society is more disabling than our disabilities ourselves.
Well, and Kevin, you make a really good point about how much at the mercy our well-being is at some fairly arbitrary decision-making processes. Like, not getting access to things that we need means that even when we're very privileged, there's also an edge of vulnerability that, like, if you can't afford to pay for your wheelchair or your medicine or your home support care yourself, the government, who would be tasked with the authority to assess whether or not you qualified for death, are the same people who are assessing whether or not you can get access to those things.
I think a friend of mine summed it up really good, is that when it comes to disability, everyone still uses the medical model.
Yeah.
And it sums it up pretty good, because we're still seen as sick or suffering. It's a medical model, and we're not wanting to be seen as a medical model. But all those programs, whether it's community services or health, are all still under the medical philosophy of, okay, keep these person alive or give them chance to prosper. It's just really unfortunate. I see it a lot within our province here in Nova Scotia, specifically around technology, and how it's not seen how technology can give someone so much more independence and access to even knowledge or internet, and that those basic things get denied. So how do you expect someone to live a prosperous and enjoy? Imagine if the internet was not accessible to you or I on a daily basis, just for general connection to our society. You throw COVID-19 on top of that, where everyone's in their house, isolated themselves. You've got a perfect storm for people lining up to die. I don't want to be frank, but you could have a perfect storm where, yeah, people will be shitty and they don't want to live because their life is shitty, not because of their disability, though.
I think that's the real concern here with Bill C-7, is it doesn't consider the precarity of disabled lives. Mm-hmm. It doesn't consider how precarious life can be with disability, and the ways in which much of the suffering that we may experience in this world is actually at the hands of the federal government, the provincial government, municipal government, even our own neighbors, right? You know, if we were to lose funding for my electric wheelchair, for instance, or if I were to lose funding for my personal support work, that would fundamentally bankrupt my family. Family would be destitute. And so now I'm left with a choice. Do I continue to live and bankrupt my family, or do I choose death and save my family from the financial burden, from the care burden? That is a horrific decision to ask people to make. But it is exactly the decision that we are setting up disabled people to make. And even more worrisome, the more disabled people that make that decision, the more of us who opt out, the cheaper we suddenly become for those very systems, the federal government, provincial government, municipal government. In many ways, the ableist society benefits from us choosing death. And as we continue to dwindle, it'll be harder and harder to get access to those resources. We're a minority as it is already. And once you start having people make those very difficult choices, those horrific choices that are not based on bodily suffering, that are not based on medical diagnoses, but are purely based because someone in Toronto decided that my ability to elevate my wheelchair to reach a higher shelf was a bonus and not a key part of my life as an independent man, that is a very, very sad state of affairs.
Do you feel that the lens in which this bill was created was primarily based on the medical model versus the social model? So for those who are unaware, the medical model being looking at disability as a flaw within someone and something that needs to be quote unquote corrected, versus the social model, which looks at disability as the society in which it exists in. So society choosing whether to install a ramp or not is in fact the issue, rather than someone who needs a ramp. So do you feel that the lens in which this creation and all of the potential consequences were hyper-focused on keeping this surrounding issue in the medical model.
I'm not sure if there was necessarily an overt desire. I don't think there was any consciousness
about either that models of that even exist.
Yeah, I think that really this is a reflection of the way in which, while I would say the activist movements to push out the concept of the social model have been remarkably successful in the last 30 years, that at the end of the day, we still live under the hegemony of the medical model. This is a reflection of our society, as opposed to an overt attempt to maintain a status quo.
Yeah, I mean, the wording of the bill very much centers the problem in the body.
Which I think is important to note. For some people, that's accurate.
Yes.
For some people, it is accurate. The issue is that the bill itself and the dialogue, the discourse around the bill, presumes that that is the truth for all.
Yeah.
And it presumes that if you are not suffering from a biological condition, that you therefore are not suffering and wouldn't make this choice.
That's true.
And that is our major concern.
Yeah, it does explicitly state that for the purposes of the bill, mental illness does not qualify as a disability. And therefore, if your suffering is considered to be as a result of mental distress, then you don't qualify. But that all presumes that people with disabilities do not also experience suffering based on mental distress, right? Mm-hmm. That like once we have a physical condition, that is the only reason that there's this inextricable link, you know, that suffering is encoded into disability and you can't separate them. And, you know, the social model, as you described, says that's not actually, it's not innate. It's not inherent in physical disability that we suffer, and that it's so complex. I think the thing is that like human suffering is itself so complex that the idea that it can be compartmentalized to apply in a unique way to a distinct group of people where the fair, ethical, noble, you know, merciful response is a facilitated death is itself philosophically so problematic, because humans experience suffering on a great range regardless of disability, you know? And so this idea that we are in this completely separate category outside of the spectrum of human experience, it won't reduce stigma against disability. It won't increase inclusion. It won't, you know, bring us into the center of the societies and the communities that we're a part of. It's an act of pushing.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to a series of highlights from the past year of programming. Again, if you wanted to support The Avalanche, be sure to support us during your funding drive. The easiest way to do so is going to ckut.ca and making a donation. Remember to check The Avalanche as your show of choice. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Air, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter at @AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalancheckut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news@ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Hearsay, that's up next.
CKUT Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Good production.
You know I'm gonna hold my dog. No, I'd rather be alone. Can't go hold me down. You can't tell me what you do, where you go, how you dress. Me no puppy show. Me a the star, so me a no fan of you. Do me wanna follow you. Me not itch up under no man arm like Roland. Boss position, son of boy can't try program me. Rebel from day one. Real bad girl, son of boy can't try program me.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
Do your own thing, stop fuck with. What if him love beg your money to? Can't pay rent and a bad yo. Can't program me. Nanny never go a war for me. Sit down in a 2020 slavery. Me no know about you, but me know about me. No man can lick me. Some girl love them man more than how them love them won't pick me. The whole man, some of them happy sex girl, must be mental. Them a fuck fi credential. You no wonder the oral, but to drop your moral fi keep man way up 24 girl, me no care.
We welcome you to another edition of Spitfire. Spitfire is a